Welcome to Becoming Parents Podcast. I'm your host, Jennifer Campbell. I'm a doula in Washoe County, Nevada, a Medicaid provider, a lactation educator, childbirth educator, and mom of 18. You can find me and connect on doulainreno.com. Remember, give a shout out to those who are brave enough to share their stories with us on how they have become parents. Let's dive in. Welcome to Becoming Parents Podcast. I'm the host, Jennifer Campbell, and today I'm here with Carl Smith, two of the most common names known to man, because I'm originally Jennifer Taylor. So you must have been born in 70 with me when parents named you something so plain it was ridiculous.
Simple.
Yes, it was very simple. How are you today?
I'm doing very well. I appreciate you inviting me to be here.
I'm so excited. I love all my guests, but I love when men step forward and really talk about the parenting journey from that perspective, because it's not the same. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it's more the same than I think women realize. And so I'm so excited about this and just the little pieces I know about your journey. I want you to jump in and start sharing your parenting journey with us.
Sure. So it actually, I would say, Jennifer, it kind of started even before I got married, right? So when I knew that, you know, I was going to get married to my now ex-wife, and kids were going to be a part of that, I did a lot of soul searching about my upbringing. And, I love my father, but there were some pretty dark times, some pretty rough times. And I kind of had to make the commitment then that that's not going to be the father I'm going to be. And everything from kind of that moment on, especially when kids came into the picture, being very conscious and being very thoughtful about, you know, how I'm approaching things and making sure the filter through which everything went through was, what's the priority? The priority is the kids. I tell you, once you have kids, you're at best number two on the list, but more likely number three or number four. So that was very purposeful. When we first started to try to have kids, we had a lot of challenges with fertility. Now, my ex-wife was an only child. Her mother was an only child. Her grandmother was a single child orphan. So, yeah. There's this long line of single, only children. And, we were definitely thinking we didn't want to do that. But we also, as we were trying to have that first child, ran into infertility. Yeah. And that was, obviously, you never expect that. You see the made for TV movies about it. And you're like, oh yeah, that it happens sometimes. It'll never happen to us, obviously. Right. And then you start that journey and it becomes, what was supposed to be this, kind of romantic, storybook thing about, having your first child and everything becomes this really clinical, cold series of doctor's visits and blood tests and shots and, one big yeah. medical procedure, so that's really kind of where that we've finally, and then when we finally conceived and had our son, Noah, it became this minor miracle. And immediately we started thinking about, what's next? Child number two. We have, we have the firstborn, we have the son. We figured this out. We know how this works. And that's where, just when you think you've kind of gotten over the hump, there's another mountain to climb. The infertility became, just continued. And then we had a series of miscarriages, and that can be dismissed like in a single sentence. Well, we had a miscarriage and blah, blah, blah. But, it becomes more and more devastating, because you're, the emotions, of saying, oh, we're pregnant and you're doing the ultrasounds and, you're picking out names and you're, doing that kind of stuff. And then boom. And it's such a gut-wrenching, emotional, and for my ex-wife, physical, it's just devastating. And you have to grieve each one of those losses. And frankly, it's at that point I said, what are we doing? You know what the world doesn't need? The world doesn't need more people. We have a lot of them. What we need are more parents. Mm. So you know, the American way to solve problems is if you can't make it, you get it. So I said, let's just, you know,
sorry.
Well, and I always tell people, you know, it's food. Kids are like food and clothes. They're a lot easier and cheaper to make than to buy. But I just said, let's just go and just get another child. There's plenty of kids out there who need, you know, need a family, and we need another child. So let's just do that. So we kind of started down the path of going into adoption. And for me, I was looking for one of my traits is to try and eliminate failure points. So what I wanted to do, we've been through this fertility thing, so which is rife with failure points, right? So how can we take this adoption thing and make it as increase the likelihood it's going to end where we need it to end? So we had some friends who had done domestic adoptions, and they talked about, you know, what they saw were the downfalls to it. And I said, I don't like the sound of some of those things. Then I thought, you know what system works efficiently? The communist system works efficiently. Let's go to China. I know the trains will run on time. And and they did, right? And that sounds ridiculous. And maybe
no,
it
does not.
But I thought, we had a blonde-haired, blue-eyed kid. Like, let's get one with brown eyes and dark hair. That seemed like a nice matching set. And I was right. I will tell you, for the challenges we had with adoption, and there were some, it was the playbook was there. Fill out this endless, inordinate pile of paperwork. Do follow these steps, write these checks, do these things, and at the end you will have a daughter. And that's exactly what happened. So we, you know, we went through the fingerprinting, we went through the background checks, we did all of those kind of crazy things. And then, you know, the picture arrived and said, here's your daughter. And, you know, and again, I like to tell you that the trip over to get her was this, you know, this Hallmark moment. It was a 2-week nightmare, that, you know, I still have the notes from it. And I published those just to kind of get them out there. You know, that involved a trip to a hospital. And I can assure you, if you don't speak Mandarin or Cantonese and you end up in a Chinese hospital, good luck. Included a doctor handing me a thermometer and saying, here, check the temperature. Like, I'm a trained medical professional. Spoiler alert, I am not. So it was just incredibly tense, tension filled 2 weeks journey that ended up with our daughter coming home. And, you know, it's ended up being one of the, my opinion, the smartest things we've ever done, and that I've ever been a part of. But I'll tell you, one of the stories that made me realize that this was why more people weren't doing this, because my thinking is, you want kids, there are kids, get a kid. It seemed pretty simple. But as we had kind of been approved to get Katie, and we had our kind of travel time set up, and I went with my my mother-in-law and my stepmother to go get Katie, as my ex-wife stayed home with our son. She was still going through fertility because we thought, well, 2 is fine, 3 is better. So she was at an appointment, and she recounted this story where she's in this room full of these other women who are kind of, you know, waiting their turn to see the doctor. And, you know, there was, you know, people were talking and sharing stories. And she said something to the effect of, like, well, you know, if this doesn't work out, it's okay, because my husband's going over to, we have adopted a girl from China. He's going over to get her. And 2 of the women burst into tears.
Oh.
And she said, what's the problem? And one of the women said to her, my husband said he won't raise a child who doesn't look like him. You know, I'll be honest, that never occurred to me. You know, thank God she doesn't look like me. I wouldn't curse that at any girl. So that really made me realize that, you know, why more people weren't doing what I thought was the obvious thing to do. So, we brought Katie home, and it's been, you know, she's been a blessing to me. And she and her brother are, you know, they're tight, and they're and the influence that they've had on each other is significant. You know, my son ended up going earning an appointment to the Naval Academy. My daughter kind of watched that. She's 4 years younger than him. Okay. She watched that and decided, for a number of reasons, not the least of which is this country giving her the opportunity she never would have had in China to grow up the way she's grown up, to say, that's what I want too. I want to be a military officer. So she pursued and earned an appointment to the Air Force Academy. So, you know, to know that they have that connection, and it's very clear that, you know, that happened only because she had a brother who showed her that pathway. You know, I think that's been fantastic. So that's probably the longest Reader's Digest version of a parenthood path ever, but those are kind of the basics.
I mean, I think it's amazing that you had the ability to look. I was very similar, that mm-hmm. you look at your childhood and think, that's not what I want. Mm-hmm. Knowing a list of things you do not want does not mean that you figure out innately the best way to do things, because I know, and also that even if you are trying to be the best parent every single day, you're not going to really make mistakes on a very regular mm-hmm. basis, you know? I mean, but I love that you said that, because I grew up the same way, where I was like, this is not going to be my life. I am not going to parent this way. I don't want to get involved with anything that could create addiction within me, mm-hmm. you know? That just means you have a list of things not to do. Mm-hmm. It's so much more challenging. I want to ask you a question, because I went through infertility, where, you know, you're doing your basal body temperature every morning and writing it down, and you're supposed to have mm-hmm. sex every other day. And there's a point where my ex-husband looked at me and, like, I never thought sex would be a chore. Like, this isn't even fun. I don't want to even do this anymore. And I think people, like, you know, that was a male perspective. We were in our early 20s when that should be like, here's your chandelier and your Superman cape. And we were like, oh my gosh, this is such a chore. Because that mentality of needing to do it to get to this final result, mm-hmm. right? And failing every month. And getting blood work done all the time, and getting shots, and getting day surgeries, and there's nothing fun. It's not, there's mm-hmm. no hallmark in there. Was that very similar to you, where you were like, I think we kind of went like, why are we even doing this? This is so far off the path of what we thought. Basically, when I hit IVF, I'd gone through 7 of the day surgeries, you know, where they're mm-hmm. testing things, and I was maxed out on Clomid and Provera, and they're like, you're not going to get pregnant. Next step is IVF. And I knew immediately that was not my path. Like, waving the white flag, I'll adopt.
Right.
So tell me just a little bit more from your perspective on that.
Yeah. So on the infertility part, it's you know, this timing is interesting, because I just rewatched this weekend the 80s movie, She's Having a Baby, where Kevin Bacon and Maureen McGovern are going through this same thing. And, you know, Kevin Bacon kind of walks in the bedroom with this, like, long face. And, you know, Maureen McGovern's like, the temperature is this, and this, mom, ovulating, you know, and he kind of staggers in there like this. And at one point she goes, and you can just watch TV if you get bored. And, like, that's, there is no joy in that at all.
Here's
and
a magazine. Exactly.
Right. And, but that was, to your point though, that to me was the epiphanal moment. Why are we doing this? Why you know, of all the things you should enjoy in life, this is like,
supposed to be the icing on the cake.
Yeah. If God gave us one blessing, the orgasm is it. Like, why has this
now
become the biggest
terrible.
Chore?
Yeah.
Thank God it's over. So that's why I said, like, what are we doing here? If really what we want is a child, then you start to think, you know, again, does a child have to look like you? Does it have to have, you know, all your characteristics? And, you know, to me, the answer was no. It had nothing to do with that. It was about
me too. Right.
That family unit, you know, and to, you know, one, a child needed a home. We had a home, and they would have a sibling. And my son, you know, I was confident was going to be a great big brother, and he has been. So, yeah, again, that's what I'm saying. When you see a movie or a TV show and they talk infertility, just think, well, I had another doctor's appointment, and you kind of dismiss it. But it consumes every moment of your day.
Yep.
It consumes every ounce of energy that you have. And it's the only thing you're thinking about. And it's not like when you're younger and you're thinking, when can we have sex? When can we do it? Can we do it here? Can we do it there? That's all you're thinking. All you're thinking is it's very tactical and it's very clinical.
Yeah. On a spreadsheet. You're writing it down on a spreadsheet. You know, I thought the same thing. It didn't have to come to me. And I did get pregnant. I also was really, I felt really blessed. I don't know if your ex-wife felt this way too, but I knew my odds of getting pregnant and carrying a baby to term were low. I was pregnant 7 times. I gave birth 4 of them. That was the miracle. When I adopted kids, they're like, oh, you took in extras. And I was like, nah, I chose those. The babies that I got to term that I gave birth to, those were the miracles. That was the crapshoot, right?
Yeah.
That was my unknown. It was so reversed from what most people think. Like doing foster care, doing adoption, doing those things, it's also a lot of time and energy. And you're making a very conscious choice, different than the pregnancies. With all of the miscarriages, and as hard as those are, when you have the expectation that that is likely, that did actually make it easier for me. And like you guys were able to have one son. Like that was a freaking miracle in all of this.
Without question.
Right. So I didn't take in extras. I gave birth to extras because I didn't expect to be able to. Right. So it's a different mentality, I think, when you're going through infertility and you're open. And I get that woman that cried in the waiting room who said, my husband would never take a child who doesn't look like me. There's something in some people where they just can't imagine. And I couldn't imagine ever being that person. So you and I are we're the total opposite. I couldn't have cared less.
Yeah. When you think about everything you go through, and I don't even think I could count how many miscarriages we went through, 5, 6, whatever. That's when you start to think, what's the cost, right, versus the odds. So if the odds are ever decreasing that we're going to get to that end, and to watch that, taking this, taking the Clomid or taking these shots and you're taking these shots, and then, you're waiting, and then you're on that clock, perform. Let's get this done. To kind of follow it through, like you were saying, you look at the odds of actually getting to term, and those to me, clearly we're getting getting pregnant, high odds, keeping it even higher, as opposed to, I'm going to go to a communist country where the trains run on time. And it was a tremendous pain. Things were being delayed. It took a year and a half to get it done. But, I felt pretty confident if we continue to do this, the odds were 99% we were going to have a child at the end of it.
And I agree.
And when I think of these people, and I only can speak to some of it, I can't raise somebody. And then I will tell you, so when I can remember being in this ridiculous conference room when we were getting the kids, and my experience, because I was there, was, one, you couldn't bring hard currency into China at the time. You couldn't bring hard US currency. I had $10,000 in hard currency, because that's what you had to do. So you're walking, and it all had to be in new bills. So I remember going to the bank and saying, I can need $10,000 broken down in these denominations, and they all need to be new bills. So you're literally going through this money, counting that 20's crinkly, got to have another one. So you're walking into this country, a communist country, with clearly, blatantly, overtly breaking one of their laws by walking in with all this currency. And then you're sitting at this, in this generic hotel conference room, any boardroom you'd ever seen in any office. It could not be less exciting. And one by one, they'd call you up, and you'd walk up, and you would hand an envelope of money to this person, and you would hand an envelope of money to this person, and you would hand a gift, which had been prescribed, bring this as the gift for the orphanage, and you would hand them, and then they would hand you the baby. It was absolutely as transactional as it possibly could have been. But as I'm sitting there, And, you know, you're sitting, I'm sitting there like looking at the two little packets of money, making sure I know which one goes to what. I'm looking at the gift. Yeah, it's the right gift. Then you have that moment where you, and I had never stopped to think about this. What if they give her to me and I don't like her?
Oh.
You know, and it, and I'm thinking, holy crap. And I'm like, what am I going to do then? Right. So then they finally call you up. And now, of course, you know, you can't think straight. So you're just, all I'm thinking now is execute, hand money to this person, hand money to that person. Here's the gift. And then they handed it to me. And that's when you realize there's a hole in your heart you didn't even know was there. And this is what fits in it. And that yeah. was, you know, I fell in love the minute they handed it to me. Thank God. You know, but there yeah. was that, there was that moment of doubt, you know, and then to me that, you know, that she was my daughter at that very moment, you know? Yeah. So, but yeah, it's that doing that calculation to her is, you know, it just, and I think people just say, well, just keep trying. And until you've been there, you realize that doesn't make sense. It didn't make sense.
I looked at overseas options, and you're correct. They have generally, they have a better system to mm-hmm. the trains are on time. That is true. Mm-hmm. It was much more, it cost more, and the time it took, like you said, a year and a half to get everything done.
Mm-hmm.
Like that seemed really challenging. So I decided to do the opposite and mm-hmm. go the foster for adoption route and work only within the US. And like, there's no right answer, but you're right. The kids are there. Every system's broken and imperfect.
Right. You're
bringing all of these crispy bills illegally to buy a child. Like, like, a contraband it's great. Like no matter where you go and how you do it, one of our mm-hmm. adoptions, you know, in the US they have 6 months to change their mind, and at 5 months right. old the parents popped back up and said, and I was at the birth, I was actually the doula, I cut the cord on this particular adoption, we were there mm-hmm. from infancy, they asked us to be the adoptive parents outside of CPS
yeah.
and at 5 months we get this email like, oh hey, I think we changed our mind. And I'm like, this is a child you've never even seen. And we adopted him. It went through, but I had to take a real hard step back and say, why don't you guys come over and spend some time at our house before mm-hmm. you make a decision and ask any questions and see where he's at and
right.
get to know him. Because I knew they had 30 days to change their mind, and there was nothing I could do about it right. if that was the decision that they made. And those things, like, regardless, it is a horrible, that was like your 2 weeks trying to get to China and stuff. We yeah. have the same situations here in the US.
Yeah.
I love that you said, and I really want to make this point, because I did adoptions at 5, 2, 3 at infants. Mm-hmm. I took in kids long-term from, you know, 9 to 11 to 3 months to 12. And it does not matter. The second that child walks into your home, mm-hmm. even that 12-year-old, even that 10-year-old, 9-year-old, right? As soon as they say, this child is here and never has to leave. This is mm-hmm. This is your child. I don't feel any differently about any one of those 10 kids that we took in, you know, from wherever, social right. services and all the peripheral ways that those 10 kids came to us and the sibling group and the whole thing. Like I've given birth and you've handed me a baby and I've taken in a 9-year-old and mm-hmm. it makes no difference.
Yeah. No, Katie is... without question. I mean, they are both my kids. And like I said, that from that moment, it never, now my ex-wife has hair very similar to mine and very blue eyes. And people would say to us, are you going to tell her she's adopted? So, well, if she can't figure that out, we're going to have some other problems to solve.
But I always did. I let my kids know where they came from. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So when did you get the picture of her, like, this is your daughter, and mm-hmm. then actually get home to the US, and how did you bridge the gap medically? Because this is a problem I've heard a lot in other countries. Mm. Language barrier, medical, you have to get clearance. What the heck is going on with them? So tell me, just give me that timeline.
Yeah. I like to tell you, like, it's, look, you get the picture, you leave the next day and she's home in a week and then it's all over. Not the case.
No.
We got the picture and, the information. I want to say it was in September, maybe.
Okay.
Summer. And then it was January I went to get her. So it was a good 6 months.
Okay.
So they give you some information, but, not much. So, you kind of do the prep work and now it's real. So you're making plans, my stepmother lived in Florida at the time. So we had to get her booked to go from Florida to LA to hook up with us and to go, LA to Beijing, my mother-in-law to come with, get all those things done, then to go get her. And those 2 weeks, boy, she was sick. She was so one, she apparently it was like a 5-hour bus ride from where they were to get to Guangzhou, where we eventually got her. So, they're driving the bus. She had a knot on her head from banging her head on the bus. So she looked like a boxer. Like, she had this big knot on her head. She was very sick. So we were going back and forth with those 2 weeks we were there. She couldn't sleep. She's sick. She's underweight. It becomes a big sleep deprivation experiment at that point, because I have this child who has no idea who I am. She's sick. Yeah. She can't sleep. So I'm not sleeping. I'm in a foreign country. And Jennifer, I will tell you, the minute they gave it to her, there was the last travel meeting we had. I remember this guy clear as day. These are a couple who had done this, and the guy had a pair of camouflage cargo shorts and a baseball cap. And he said, look, he goes, I'm just going to talk to the guys here. No offense. He goes, but guys, you're on a mission. Get her out, get her home. And I'm like, that's okay. Like, I'm target locked. All I could think of is, I got to get her home. I got to get her the hell out of here and I got to get her home.
Yeah.
So, we're going through all these, we're seeing people, and they had these check-ins with doctors. And I don't think these people were any more doctors than you and I are astronauts who've been to Mars, right. But they had a lab coat on. So, they said, yeah. I said, well, she's this and she's that. And they said, well, do you want another baby? Like, what? They said, well, if you don't like this one, we'll get you another one. I'm like, no. Cause I said at that moment, like, no, this is my child now. I'm just like, I need a decongestant is all I'm asking for. Near the end, they did this last check-in. Now, bear in mind, it's been 2 weeks. She's sick as a dog. She's barely eating. I have not slept more than an hour at a time in 2 weeks. I'm in a foreign country. I'm frazzled. And they said, are you happy with the baby? And I just started going on and on. She's not sleeping and I can't sleep. And I'm trying to get her to eat and she's just sick and she's turning red and she's got the tita and going on and on and on, and I'm sitting with my head down. And they said, are you happy with the baby? Yes. Stamp, stamp, stamp. Next. That was that. So I finally get her home. She ends up getting pneumonia. She has pneumonia. Right. So
like, you can get her. You got her. You just wanted to get her out as fast as you can. She's sick. Just get her on the plane and get her out, which I've heard before. So you get home and then you can actually speak English to a doctor, as a doctor.
Correct.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
We're like 2 days in. And my ex-wife says to me, you have to come down, or she's breathing like this. I said, okay, got to go to the emergency room. And the hospital across the river had this thing called PEDS Express at the time, where kids got first priority. So that's where we're going. I went over there and the doctor says, well, she has pneumonia. We'll keep her overnight. And I said, you're absolutely not. There's no way I'm letting this child go. And so the doctor looks at me and goes, okay, well, I'm gonna have to give her a shot. I'm like, well, okay, fine. He says, it's too much medicine to put into one injection. So we're gonna put one in each leg. And he pulls out these two samurai swords that to me look like they're a foot long each. And he says, I'm like, he goes, well, I have to put one in each leg. He goes close. He goes, you're going to have to hold her down. So I literally laid on top of her. And if you think that like a 12 pound child cannot push
pick you
a
off,
grown man,
yeah. Oh, they can.
He put, and it was, and it was heartbreaking, but that's what he put these two massive needles into her and injected it. And we brought her back. Eventually she started eating. And you mentioned language. Apparently the orphanage spoke Cantonese. And when she got to Beijing, they were speaking Mandarin or vice versa. And then I show up speaking English. So here's a surprise. She was delayed speaking. We never thought she'd say a word. So that, you know, that begot speech therapy when she got older. We had the whole medical thing. Then we found out, because my ex-wife didn't come with me, that we had to readopt her in the United States. So there was a whole nother mountain of paperwork to go through. It's, you know, you watch the movie and it's, oh, we brought her home and everything was beautiful. And it was a real, real stretch. And, you know, then she had, bear in mind, in China, they don't hold these kids, right?
No.
And I wouldn't let her go. So I was like a crack dealer. Like I had the stuff. So she was clinging on to me. I can remember coaching my son in football and having practice on Thursday and doing it with her stuck to my hip. Yep. Because she wouldn't let me go. Well, now she'd get used to this other being in the house who also wanted my attention. And my son lost clumps of hair just that she would just rip out of his head. But that just was all part of the my son actually said, you know, if she's not going to love me, Dad, we're going to have to send her back. you work to overcome those kind of things.
You do.
And it's all part of the process.
It is. And it's not easy. It's not at the end of the movie, the music comes on and she takes your hand and looks deeply into your eyes and says, I love you, Daddy. Because it's not like there are great moments, but I think realizing that it's hard. Infertility is really, really hard and gut wrenching. Mm. And adoption's really, really hard and gut wrenching.
Yeah.
And it's just which kind of really, really hard and gut wrenching do you want?
Right.
You did both. I did both. Right. Like, let's do all of them. Okay.
Yeah.
Sign me up for that. And in the end, though, it's totally worth it. And you get through it. And you do the speech and you do the touching and you do the medical and you hold them and they stop pulling out the hair and they start talking. Right. And like all of those things happen. But yeah, it's definitely, what a challenge.
Yeah.
You have a business.
And well,
you
yeah,
are an
I,
author.
A little bit. Yes.
I want to finish our podcast talking about what you do, because your kids are now adults. Mm. You've gone through this whole thing. You're not married to the same person anymore because you've said ex-wife. So look at me, like I'm like a private detective here. Yeah. Bridge that gap and tell me what you're doing now and how that can help people.
Sure. So one thing I've been doing with both my kids is I've been blogging a lot about their experience in the military academies. So I have a blog called mykidthemid.com and another one, mykidthecadet.com, where I talk about, you know, I've kind of shared their journeys, which has introduced me to a lot of people who have shared some of the same struggles. And as far as like Katie goes, it's also introduced me to some people who've gone through the adoption process, because obviously they see me and her together and it's obvious that, you know, we're not biologically connected.
Yes.
Yeah. So, you know, we're able to, you know, I've been able to touch a lot of people in that way. I've also been writing. I took all the notes. I did nothing but take the notes from my adoption journey with Katie from those 2 weeks and publish them, mainly so she could have them. There's a record of them. But other people have picked up that and, you know, it's helped them kind of understand that journey a little bit. I did a research book called Anchored in Tradition, which is really just about the Naval Academy. And I'm currently should be published by the end of March, working on my life as a military academy parent, where I share, you know, Katie's journey from being adopted to, you know, becoming eventually going to be an Air Force officer, and my son from, you know, the fertility challenge that we had with him to, you know, now being, you know, he's about to do his third deployment as an officer on a submarine. So, you know, I think that's to be able to share that, I'm excited to share that journey as well. So that's kind of how I've kind of brought the parenting thing out to the forefront. But my kids' journey has been very public. You know, when I adopted Katie, I wrote about that for the website I was working for at the time. And I've had these notes, you know, the time with Noah, his whole challenge of getting into the Naval Academy and his challenge in his 4 years there and his challenge as an officer, that's all been very, very public. So, that's what's happening there.
I love that they're good with that, because they'd have to be good with you sharing their story. I know sometimes that can be like a line you have to navigate. So I think
I'll tell you, Jennifer, like someone said to my son, what do you think about that? He goes, I didn't realize there was another option.
Even better way to do it. Exactly. That's the best way to do it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Carl, thank you so much for being on. I so appreciate you sharing your journey with us. Holy cow. What a ride.
Yeah. It's been my pleasure, Jennifer. Thank you for the time and for the opportunity. I appreciate it.